I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. Rather than wait any longer, we're going to go ahead and get started with some public hearings. We won't be going in order of the agenda today, so you know. We're going to start off with public hearings at the bottom of the agenda and maybe in the middle of the bottom. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2090.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that establishes as an unlawful trade practice the use, disclosure, or disposal of information that's requested, required, or received from a customer if it's not done in the manner or for the purpose stated to the consumer on their website or in the consumer agreement. There is a dash one amendment that adds that it is an unlawful trade practice to collect, maintain, or delete information that's requested, required, or received from the consumer.
Thank you. So up first, let's have the Attorney General Rosenblum, Representative Huffman, and Representative Williamson. Good afternoon. Thank you for making yourself available on a busy day, I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since my testimony is going to be shortest, can I go?
Yes.
Would that be okay?
Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Kind of out of the ordinary for you to be so presumptuous.
For me to jump in like
but
that?
But go ahead.
I did ask permission. I'm John Huffman, State Representative for House District 59. This is a simple bill, Mr. Chair. It basically says if I say I'm going to do something, then that's what I'm going to do. That's the bottom line of it. And certified smart people to my left are now going to give the real and weighted testimony. Thank you for your time.
First, should we have questions of Representative Huffman?
I have a lot of them, but not for this
bill. We had an agreement, sir.
Okay, go ahead.
All right.
Sorry.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Bynum, Representative Evans. For the record, I'm Jennifer Williamson, State Representative, House District 36, and I'm here today as a chief co-sponsor with Representative Huffman on House Bill 2090. Whether we're paying bills online, signing up for a subscription service, or tracking our daily fitness through a ubiquitous thing on our wrist, we pass a lot of personal information to companies through the internet and wireless devices, often much more information than we realize. And many of these businesses post policies that spell out what happened to the information once they receive it. But there are a few protections to actually ensure that what they say on their website or in their use policies is actually what happens. So very simply, this bill makes it so companies have to actually carry out their own privacy policies. It makes it an unfair trade practice to use consumer information in a way that is inconsistent with their own policies. Enforcement for this would fall under the purview of the Attorney General, who currently enforces unlawful trade practices. And nationally, there's a new urgency for this type of legislation as Congress targets online consumer privacy protections. Just last week, the Senate voted to scrap the FCC regulations that prevented internet service providers from sharing customer usage information with advertisers. At a time when we have more personal information than ever floating around the internet, it's more important than ever that we seek to strengthen protections for consumers. And I believe in this bill we have an opportunity to do that in the state of Oregon. Representative Huffman and I have been in front of this committee and many others together on our work to ensure transparency and protection for consumers and accountability for persons or company in possession of our personal information. And so this bill is one in a long line of bills that we've worked on together. And so I ultimately believe that consumers deserve to know where their information is and that it be kept private. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, Vice Chairs Barreto and Bynum, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm Ellen Rosenblum, Attorney General for Oregon, here to testify in support of House Bill 2090. I also want to take a moment to thank the lead sponsors on this bill, Representatives Huffman and Williamson, who've been leading the charge on protecting the privacy of Oregonians. Thank you so much to them and to all of you for considering this bill. As early as today, or as recently as today, in the Business Day section of the New York Times, there is a lead article entitled "States Seek to Step In on Privacy for Web." It's not about this bill, but it could have been. So I commend you to your attention. Of course, we're stepping in on a lot of things. Ours is truly the age of big data, and it's only getting bigger. I have enclosed within my materials a graphic from the company Domo that shows how much data is produced by a handful of prominent internet sites and web services every minute. Just in the United States, 3.5 million texts are sent every minute. 400 hours of video are shared on YouTube in less time than it's going to take me to testify before you today. As consumers share more and more information from their phones, their cars, even their pacemakers, they are helping industries grow and develop new products. In fact, it's not an exaggeration to say that the internet is built on our data, understanding it, interpreting it, and most of all, acquiring ever more of it. And while this information is undoubtedly useful, it also includes our most personal data and decisions. Every purchase we make, every website we visit, every medical condition we put into WebMD, every time we look for a lawyer, every time we try to find a therapist online. It's important to pause and think about how all this information, sometimes very personal information, is used and the representations we rely on about its dissemination and its use. We need to have truth in the digital age. The Harvard Business Review recently came out with a report calling the data ethics debate, quote, one of the greatest ethical challenges of our time. It also said, we cannot put the big data genie back in the bottle, and we ignore its risks at our peril. House Bill 2090, as has been mentioned, is a pretty simple bill. It says that if a company represents to you that they use your data in a certain way, they're obligated to follow through and keep their promise. If they materially stray from using your information, from what they've represented, then that is a violation of our consumer protection law. It's not right for a company to tell you they'll use your data one way and then decide to use it for something else without telling you. Oregonians have a basic right to be free from fraudulent or misleading tactics or representations from the companies with which they choose to do business. That principle has been a bedrock of Oregon consumer protection for a long time. But data goes a lot further than simple broken promises. We are increasingly accustomed to providing very sensitive information to the companies with which we do business. Where we live, what we buy, again, our medical information, financial information. We do not, however, renounce our rights to this data just because we've chosen to share it within a business relationship. This data is valuable. In fact, that's precisely their interest in collecting it. And when we lose control of it, we expose ourselves to our personal information being used in ways we did not approve of. In the gentlest case, that can be targeted advertising and other marketing, which exploits that information for a commercial purpose we might not have agreed to. In the worst case, it can land in the hands of scammers. Your data says a lot about you. Your address, your consumer purchasing preferences, your age, again, your medical anxieties, all of these are data points that can be used to target you. So we are saying you should have a right to rely on what you've been told about this data is going to be collected, maintained, and disclosed or used. Consumers should be free, of course, to contract with businesses, however they choose. And this bill respects that consumer choice. This bill doesn't say anything about how much or even what information companies can collect. But instead, it simply requires that what a company tells the consumer about the uses of that information is true. To provide an example, the Federal Trade Commission took action against an app maker. You could download an app on your phone for shopping coupons or free Wi-Fi, and the retailer could track your geolocation in the store. They tracked your movement so they could learn more about traffic patterns. In their privacy policy, they said they would tell you when you were being tracked. They also said they would provide a way for you to opt out of being tracked. However, their promises did not ring true. They did not provide a way to opt out in the manner they said, and they did not tell you when you were being tracked. Let me conclude with a quote from today's New York Times article from David Vladek, a professor at Georgetown Law School and the former director of the Federal Trade Commission's Consumer Protection Bureau. He says, "What you're seeing is the growing recognition of the intrusiveness of these technologies and some efforts not to regulate them out of existence, but to regulate them in ways that allow people who care about this to preserve their own privacy." So please consider House Bill 2090 as a good way for Oregonians to preserve their privacy. Again, with the substantial risk to our privacy at stake, we need truth in the digital age, and this bill is a very good step to help us to get there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Committee, now's the time for questions of Representative Huffman. Are there any questions at all? Seriously, no questions. So just one question. This doesn't say that somebody can't or a vendor can't put in their contract that we're going to use your information for a specific purpose. That if, as long as that's in the agreement or contract, then that's still okay.
Chair Halvey, members of the committee, that's exactly right. This bill doesn't address that. Another bill could, but this one does not.
Okay, great. No other questions?
Just to follow up, so I'm sorry.
Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got here a little late, so I missed some of that. So they don't have to have an upfront policy just if they decide to use it? Is that the way this works, your data? Do they have to notify you in advance of receiving your data?
Chair Halvey, Representative Kinnemer. There are very few requirements of exactly what these companies have to do. Many of them do have already something that they refer to as privacy policies that do discuss, although you'd have to spend a couple of hours with a little, you know, glass to read it, what they are. But there are currently no laws specifically, other than those that some of which this body has passed, for example, with respect to the data of children, K through 12, you'll recall the OSIPA law that was passed the last major session. But as a general matter, and of course HIPAA and other laws that apply, but otherwise, as a general matter, companies can collect and do collect just about anything that they want. And so that's why this is so important, because it is about letting folks know, as a general matter, how their data is being used. Most companies do that. They need to make good on those representations, because that's what we're relying on when we sign up for an app or when we provide information.
Just one more comment, if I could. It's been interesting. My family's been doing a little bit of business on eBay, and it's amazing how much of our data they use. Now, according to their instructions, they don't share it with others, but it's amazing to me to realize how interesting it is to see patterns that you're maybe not even aware of or catch members of the family doing various and sundries. And catch was probably a bad choice of words.
Yes.
Discover.
one other question perhaps would be, you know, for somebody that goes through identity theft, for example, and somebody's obviously disclosed information somewhere, I've looked into that before and found it almost impossible to find out where the breach in the security actually happened as a consumer. You know, who disclosed your information is the question. So how does a consumer, you know, get that information about where the breach was?
Right. Thank you, Chair Halvey, members of the committee. That can be very difficult, and that's why, fortunately, there are some great ways now, if you feel that you have had your identity stolen, to attempt to get help, especially at the federal level, to have that tracked. And, of course, you can also report it to the Oregon Attorney General, and we will try to assist you in that regard. There are, and again, thanks to the legislature, we now have an updated law with respect to these matters, so that we can, you know, certainly hold accountable under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act those companies that are in violation that don't comply with the data breach laws. So we're very pleased to have that also as of just a session or two ago.
Well, and Chair Halvey, I would just add that this doesn't make it easier to figure out where that breach was, but it does give you some sort of action if you find out that a website or an app gave your information in a way that you didn't agree to. So it gets at the issue a little bit, but it doesn't make it easier to figure out where that information originally was shared.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate all your work on this. It looks like a very good step forward. Thank you very much for your testimony. Up next, Shamus Linsky. And Cheryl, did you want to testify? No, she's good.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Seamus Linsky. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Consumer League, and I'm testifying in favor of House Bill 2090. The panel before me stated everything eloquently. I just wanted to add that the Oregon Consumer League, one of our core missions and policies is protecting consumer privacy and the integrity of online data. And so this is a very common sense bill that simply holds online entities accountable to their own privacy policies. So please vote yes on House Bill 2090.
Thank you. Questions for Seamus? Thanks for your testimony today.
Thank you.
No one else seems signed up for House Bill 2090, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2090. And we will open a, just for anybody that's here on House Bill 2670, it's been removed from our calendar. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2356, and concurrently we'll open House Bill 3188.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2356 establishes requirements under which a debt buyer may bring legal action to collect debt, specifies notice that debt buyer must provide to the debtor, and it makes a violation of the requirements an unlawful collection practice. There are no amendments to House Bill 2356. And House Bill 3188 prohibits a person from engaging in business as a debt buyer without certification from DCBS. It prescribes procedures for applying for the certificate, requires the debt buyer to send certain information to the debtor who requests the information in writing, requires the debt buyer that brings action to collect the debt to possess and be able to produce information, provides that the debt buyer or debt collector is not liable for unlawful collection practices if a preponderance of evidence shows that the unlawful collection was not intentional, exempts the debt buyer from the definition of a collection agency. And there are no amendments on that measure either.
Thank you. The Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum, and Cheryl Heemstra. Good afternoon again. If you'd identify yourself for the record again,
thank
please.
You. Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, Vice Chairs Bredo and Bynum, and members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum, and I'm Oregon's Attorney General. And I have with me Cheryl Heemstra. I know you know Cheryl. She's been working very hard on this bill and others. I'm grateful for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2356. Since the Department of Justice started releasing its list of top 10 consumer complaints more than a decade ago, complaints against the debt collection industry have repeatedly appeared near the top. Since January of 2015 alone, my Consumer Protection Unit has received more than 540 complaints involving debt collection. Today, we focus in on one area of this world that has grown significantly in the last decade, debt buyers. What we refer to as debt buyers are companies who buy debt that has been charged off by an original creditor. Because this debt is typically old or difficult to collect, debt buyers are able to purchase large quantities of consumer debt at a significant discount. The debt is bought and sold like any other commodity, but the problem is that debt is not like a regular commodity. It's vastly more complex, and the issues involved more perilous. Debt involves compounding interest, statute of limitations, possibly previous negotiations, changes of names and addresses, and at the extremes can also involve unfair collection practices, mistaken identities, and basic unfairness to Oregon consumers. Because these debts are purchased en masse for pennies on the dollar, they often come with very little information from the seller of the debt. They may not have accurate information about the amount owed because the debt buyer is supplied with just a massive spreadsheet of names and numbers. And because the requirements for collecting on a debt are minimal, this can lead to a lot of problems. To provide a few examples lifted from our library of consumer complaints, debt buyers may try to collect debts from the wrong consumers. They may try to collect debts without providing any hard information about why the debt is owed. We also have examples of debt buyers attempting to collect on debts that have already been paid in full, medical debts that are clearly covered by the Oregon Health Plan, or debts that are well outside of the statute of limitations. Here's what what happens that brings us here today. A consumer will be sent notice of a lawsuit by the debt buyer in the mail. Since this consumer never did business directly with the debt buyer, this correspondence is often sent by a company that the consumer has never heard of, referencing a debt only by a string of numbers or outstanding balance. If somebody tells you that you owe $800 because you didn't pay off your Target card in 2008, that's one thing. When they tell you you owe $800 on an account with a number you don't recognize to a company you've never heard of, that's another. In a world where so much of what we receive in the mail is either junk mail or at best junk mail, and at worst a scam, it's easy to understand how even a well-informed consumer might be confused or even ignore the mailing. Our study of Oregon small claims cases revealed that consumers only appear in court in roughly 5% of cases, which resulted in default judgments then most of the time. These default judgments not only mean possible wage garnishment, but they can significantly damage credit scores, blocking housing or transportation. There's also a significant impact on our court system, and there are a lot of these cases. More than 300,000 cases just in Oregon's small claims courts have involved the collection of a debt in the past 5 years. This incentivizes some risky behavior by debt buyers. Buy debt on 1,000 consumers, file a court action against all of them, and you know that statistically speaking, 950 will have default judgments entered against them. It might not be a bad business model, but it's not good for consumers. To be clear, many consumers do legitimately owe debt and fail to pay it back. And debt collectors do need a legitimate means to collect that debt. But in order to collect on a debt, creditors should have to provide some proof that the debt is actually owed. There are currently simply not enough requirements for debt buyers to ensure they provide accurate information to bring a lawsuit and succeed in our court system. This is just unjust and unfair. And this is why I urge you to pass this bill. The bill would require debt buyers to be licensed by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So there is some oversight about how debt buyers are operating. This bill would establish basic requirements for the information debt collectors must provide to consumers in order to bring them to court. It would further require debt buyers to provide some modicum of proof that the debt is legally collectible in order to obtain a judgment in their favor. House Bill 2356 seeks a fair balance between protecting Oregon consumers while also protecting the debt buyer's valid right to collect debts that are owed. I want to thank the group of stakeholders that have been providing feedback for this bill. Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center, the Debt Collectors Association, Debt Buyers Association, the Oregon State Bar, the Oregon Judicial Department, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and the Center for Responsible Lending. We believe with the Dash One Amendment, we have come to a great middle ground that will provide real protection for consumers while still allowing the good operators in Oregon to conduct business in a manner that's both fair and profitable. We're happy to keep working with the stakeholders. Thank you for allowing me to testify today on this matter, and I'm happy, along with Cheryl, to take any questions you might have.
Thank you. Cheryl, I know that we've been working on an amendment with the stakeholders, and it is being uploaded to OLIS as we speak. And so I know the committee members and I still have not seen it out of LC, but we did see the work product that went in. So you're happy, I'd be happy to have you describe, you know, where we're at.
Thank you. Chair Holby and members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice. As the chair mentioned, we've been working on a draft amendment for some time now with the stakeholders you heard mentioned, and we're happy to keep working on that. As yet, I have not seen how they've come out of LC, so we will continue to work with stakeholders on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much information do they have on the debtors and the debt that they've incurred when these debt buyers buy a package like that? I mean, you had said, you know, they might get a letter from an attorney they've never heard of, which may be a case number that they're not familiar with. And so it seems like if these debt buyers are buying the debt, they should have some specifics on that they could then refer to the person they're trying to collect from.
Chair Hovey, Representative Barreto, the information they get varies, of course, from sale to sale. What we've seen often is just a spreadsheet with a name, a number, and an amount. So pretty bare bones information is what's being bought and sold. And then hopefully what comes in the Dash 1 amendment, it says that if you're bringing a case to court, that there's some basic information you have to put in the pleading in the initial document.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. So from where you are right now, if LC brings back the language you're hoping they will, is everybody agreed? And if everybody isn't agreed, who's not and why?
Chair Hovey, Representative Evans, we'll get right down to that, I guess. We'll see what comes back from LC. We might have one or two tweaks to do on the language. We were in negotiations as recently as Friday, dealing with ironing out the final few things. I'm guessing you're going to hear some objection from the Debt Buyers Association or the what do they call that? The Receivable Management Association, as they've been rebranded themselves, I think. I think that would be it for opposition. The reason I think they oppose is, and hear from them, but I think they want to incorporate some of their own standards, and we would like to see a more public process for the standards that are made. And as well, we want to see some protections in court for some of these cases as well.
So. Okay.
Thank you. Seeing any other questions, thank you for your work and paying attention to this. I know it's been an issue in the legislature for at least 6 years that I can think of, perhaps more. So thank you very much for your continued efforts.
Thank you, Chairman.
Up next, Sybil Hebb, April Custers, and Seamus Linsky this time.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of House Bill 2356. I really want to thank the chair and all of the stakeholders, and particularly the Attorney General's office and Cheryl Heemstra for bringing this conversation forward and for having such a process to allow such good input. It's an important issue. Impacts our clients greatly. Our clients, as you know, are low-income Oregonians. If someone is struggling to get by and really trying down to the very last penny to take care of their family and pay their rent and buy food for the family, if there is a debt that is unfair or inappropriate and a bank account is garnished as a result or credit history is impacted as a result, there are just huge ramifications. And so it's really important to us, and we really appreciate the attention that's been put into creating a system where I think we can all, from all sides, have greater reliance on the efficacy and the accuracy of these judgments. I just wanted to check or to talk about a couple of key points of what we believe will be in the Dash 1 amendments. Before I do that, I want to say that debt collection is a legitimate business practice. We want these regulations to allow these businesses to thrive while making sure that we have some reasonable sidebars to make sure that vulnerable folks and anyone really is protected from any abuse. So that's the goal, and we think these amendments are a good striking of that balance. The first thing I wanted to talk about was the regulation of the debt buying industry, and you heard testimony previously about some of the inaccuracies or the lack of information that is provided to consumers and to the court sometimes in seeking a judgment. So we really appreciate the information that's required to be set out in the pleadings when a pleading is put forward, and we also appreciate that there will be agency oversight so that there will be licensing and regulation of some basic minimum fair standards, and that provides, I think, assurance for consumers that they'll be treated fairly. two other key points of the Dash 1 amendments that I particularly wanted to address have to do with amendments to the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. And these provisions would apply to debt collectors as well as debt buyers and anyone seeking to collect a debt. And there are a couple of key pieces that have been of great concern to our clients in the last few years. One has to do with collection of debt that is covered by Medicaid or by the Oregon Health Plan. State and federal law prohibit the pursuing of judgment or debt collection against a person who is covered by the OHP or by Medicaid. And so that's been long codified. Unfortunately, what we see sometimes is those debts getting referred to collection. And when that happens and there is continued pursuit, it is the most vulnerable and most the lowest income of Oregonians who pay the price. And I just wanted to share two quick examples to illustrate what happens there. And one is from the Albany area, a woman who was pregnant, presented to the ER, the emergency room, for treatment. She was covered by OHP at the time. Bills were sent to her for the coverage of these are expensive services. She was sent a bill. She said, hey, I'm covered by OHP. Collection stopped, and then a lawsuit was filed against her. She got into small claims court and contacted the collection agency again. They were giving her a minute to come up with sort of verification from OHA that she was, from the Oregon Health Authority, I'm sorry, that she was covered, and in the meantime filed for a default. And so there was a judgment against her. Luckily, we were able to help her, and her bank account was not garnished and her wages were not garnished. But that's the example of what can happen. And so the bill prohibits the collection of debts that are covered by OHP or Medicaid if the collector knew or by the exercise of reasonable diligence had reason to know that it was covered. So we appreciate that and think it will be very protective. Another example of a father with a child who has asthma, repeated visits to the ER, as we know that can sometimes be the case. These were people who are covered with OHP continually. Some visits they didn't receive bills for, some visits they did. And so, you know, when we raised the case in that particular circumstance, there was not a cessation of the attempts to collect until there was a lawsuit that was filed. And so we don't want to have to get to that point. The next point I wanted to raise was related to collections of debts that have expired or are beyond the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations exists for a reason, and we want to make sure that that it's prohibited to try to collect debts that have already expired. Right now, under current law, it's sort of an affirmative defense. The person who is being sued has to know that that is a defense and raise it. We know that so many of these cases are default judgments, and many consumers sued in these circumstances may lack the sophistication to understand the nature of the statute of limitations. They may not have access to legal assistance, and they may not be able to raise those claims. So we want to make sure that if there is reason to know that a debt is expired, it's a violation to sue anyway. The last thing I just wanted to mention was collection of debts that do not exist. That sounds very common sense. We want to make sure that it's clear in the statute that if there is an attempt to collect a debt that doesn't exist, that it's a violation of the Unlawful Debt Collections Practices Act. And the example that I would like to share for the committee, just to sort of illustrate what we're talking about here, comes from a woman named Shirley who shared her story with me. She was is a 65-year-old nurse. She's been a longtime nurse practitioner. She had surgery a couple of years ago. She's a sophisticated consumer in that she knew how to read her medical records. She received bills for some very expensive bills for the provision of what's called, I didn't know this term, forced oxygen assistance. She knew that she had not received supplemental oxygen because she was conscious during the time. She was able to review her medical records and note that they all noted, apparently this is a term, in-room air. And so she was able to defend herself in small claims court. She won. She got a dismissal, what's called with prejudice, meaning the judge is saying this is settled, there are no further lawsuits on this matter. She went out about her business. A few years later, she tried to pay her electric bill, and her bank account had been wiped out because the same creditor had sued on the same judgment in the same court and gotten a default judgment against her. She hadn't received notice and then garnished her bank account immediately. She suffered credit sanctions as a result. She had bounced checks as a result. That, you know, so just the unraveling that is a huge issue, and we want to create disincentives from the first place. So we really appreciate all the work that's gone into this and the participation of the stakeholders in these provisions, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.
Chair Hulvey, members of the committee, my name is April Custers, and I'm the Assistant Director of Portland State University Student Legal Services. We represent PSU students in their various legal problems, and I'm here today on behalf of my student clients, and I see a lot of attempts to collect debts that are past the statute of limitations, but I really wanted to share a story of one of my students for a debt that does not exist, and it does happen. So my student, the second week of class, was surprised to find her bank account completely drained. And for those of you who know, most students get their first check at the beginning of school, and then they have to live the whole rest of the term off of that student loan disbursement. So that's a bad thing to find out at the beginning of school. So she called her bank account to figure out what the heck happened, and it turned out that a debt collection agency had drained her account. And it was only then that she found out that she had a default judgment against her. They had served an address that she didn't live at. So she's trying to figure out what this debt is for and calls the debt collection agency, and they say it's a medical debt. Now, she's pretty young and healthy, so that doesn't make a lot of sense. She's trying to rack her brain, what would a medical debt come from? She had a couple of appointments when she was a teenager, but that would have been covered by her parents' insurance. And then she was in a car accident a few years ago, so that would be her best guess. Trying to figure out, well, is this from the car accident? But that was covered by insurance, too. So she gets a hold of her PIP file, the car insurance payment, and that took a bit of time. She gets the whole itemized amount. And it doesn't match what she got from debt collection agency, who, by the way, their documentation was the sort of table that you would make on a Word document. You know, you fill in the columns and the rows yourself. So three columns, a couple of rows, and the columns were date, amount, and the original creditor. So date, amount, and the medical provider. Her insurance documents didn't match that table, so next step, get a hold of the medical provider and try to get those documents. That takes a long time, too, by the way. And once we finally heard back from the medical provider, they couldn't verify that debt either. Now, this took months, and in the meantime, she's in school. That means that she could lose her housing, not being able to pay for rent. That means you could drop out of school because you can't pay for the term, for the next term, because you'd have to take out a temporary loan in order to make it to the next term. So I'm testifying in favor of House Bill 2356, anything that would create more requirements, especially in these pleadings, because so many of them are defaulted, to have at least a minimum amount of information to prove that the debt exists. Thanks.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Hulvey and members of the committee, my name is Seamus Linsky. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Consumer League, and I'm here to testify today on behalf of Oregon consumers to encourage you to vote yes on House Bill 2356. Our interest here today is in protecting consumers whose lives have been seriously disrupted because of the lack of due diligence in the current practices of the debt buyer and collection industry. So, as you've heard in previous testimony, the whole business model of the debt buyer industry is to buy written off debt for pennies on the dollar, and then try and collect as much of that as they can to maximize profit. And that's all perfectly legal. The problem arises when debt buyers hastily file lawsuits without ensuring that the person that they're suing is the right person or that the debt is collectible. And unfortunately, this leads to too many Oregonians improperly having their wages garnished or liens put on their property. And this issue is widespread enough that a couple of years ago, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau stepped in on behalf of consumers nationally to rein in a couple of the larger national debt buying companies. The CFPB found Encore Capital Group and Portfolio Recovery Associates, quote, bought debts that were potentially inaccurate, lacking documentation, or unenforceable. And then, without verifying the debt, the companies collected payments by pressuring consumers with false statements or churning out lawsuits using robo-signed court documents. So we believe that House Bill 2356 is a step in the right direction to fix this. It will require debt buyers to file an affidavit with the court, according to the -1 amendments that we haven't quite seen the final version of, but we believe it will require debt buyers to file an affidavit with the court before receiving the default judgment stating that they actually have the underlying documentation that proves that the person they are suing is actually the person who owes the debt and that the debt is actually collectible, meaning it's not already paid off or discharged in bankruptcy or beyond the statute of limitations. We also appreciate that House Bill 2356 gives DCBS and the Attorney General's Office the power to protect consumers by enforcing the provisions in the bill. And we'd also like to acknowledge that this is a complex issue, and we really appreciate that many stakeholders have worked together on this bill, from the Judicial Department, the Oregon State Bar, the Attorney General's Office, consumer advocates, and the debt buyers and collectors themselves. So the Consumer League would like to continue to work with stakeholders and watch the progress of the bill to ensure that the final bill strengthens consumer protections. And if it does pass, we will be watching to ensure that the bill is having the intended effect of weeding out these unwarranted lawsuits, and it's no longer hurting innocent consumers and allowing the state to go after bad actors. So with that, we'd like to encourage you to vote yes on House Bill 2356. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Doherty.
I mean, this may be kind of a silly question, but people whose wages have been garnished and so on, do they get no notification, or does the envelope have something to say? I mean, because I throw away a lot of mail without opening it, you know, saying, don't throw this away. I mean, how can somebody not be informed a couple of times about something like this?
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, it's different with respect to wage garnishment than it is with respect to garnishment of a bank account. I can speak about garnishment of a bank account. There's no notice to the consumer in that circumstance.
Really?
And I think that's by design, because people don't, you know, legitimately people want to be able to collect the debt. And I think the concern is if the consumer knew that the garnishment was coming, they might empty the bank account to protect themselves, and then it wouldn't be an effective form of enforcement. With respect to wage garnishment, the employer gets notice, and I know less about how that works. So
and you get 45 days to respond to the garnishment with request. So you get notice, but you get notice after the writ goes out.
Other questions?
Yeah, no problem.
I will note that the hearing is open for House Bill 3188, and I'm not sure that any of you signed up for it, so I guess that's kind of a moot point. But I will note the Attorney General did sign up, or the Department of Justice did, in opposition to 3188, though they didn't exactly say that on the record. So if you have a difference of opinion, you should make certain to correct that if it's wrong. So thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, David Reed and Mike Roskam.
I don't know.
No, it does.
What do they?
Yeah. We have a few. And I was
go ahead. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is David Reed. Good afternoon, Chairman Holvey and respected members of the committee. I am a Director of Government Affairs and Policy at DBA International. DBA International is the nonprofit trade association that represents over 550 companies nationwide that either purchase or support the purchase of receivables on the secondary market. These companies are frequently referred to as debt buying companies, the focus of the two bills before you. DBA International is the preeminent national leader in promoting strong and ethical business practices within the receivables management industry. DBA's receivables management certification program is the single most comprehensive source of uniform standards that have been adopted in the nation relating to debt collection for the receivables industry. The DBA certification standards were designed to go above and beyond the requirements of both state and federal laws and regulations by requiring certified companies to comply with over 75 additional requirements that are contained within the 47 program standards. This certification program began through conversations with both the CFPB and the FTC back in 2011. They strongly encouraged the industry to develop a self-regulatory program. The board of directors discussed and decided to move forward with a self-regulatory program. In 2012, we spent 8 months developing this certification program and consulted both the CFPB and the FTC on numerous occasions for their input and feedback, and which was incorporated into the certification program. Both the CFPB and FTC have been very supportive of the program since it's been adopted. In fact, most recently, in August of 2016, with the SBRIFA rulemaking process for debt collection, the CFPB actually referenced our certification program five different times within the regulatory documents that the CFPB prepared. It goes without saying that all debt-buying companies must also comply with the requirements of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, the Service Members Civil Relief Act, the United States Bankruptcy Code, the Federal Trade Commission Act, and the Dodd-Frank Act. I would note that our certification program, which is constantly evolving, we get feedback all the time from different stakeholders. Groups, and the bankruptcy code was actually added, actually at the request of a meeting with the Attorney General Rosenblum back in 2014. So we frequently take feedback that we receive and incorporate it during our annual review process. DB International has zero tolerance for bad actors within the industry. Bad actors harm both the consumer and the legitimate business community. So we view our certification program as a consumer protection program because it provides these additional protections that state and federal laws do not provide. Are we perfect? No. I mean, we're constantly striving to be perfect, but I think perfection is an elusive goal. But that's the reason why we have an annual review process of our certification program. We're constantly looking for industry best practices, new industry best practices, recent case law, as well as recent statutory and regulatory changes to ensure that the program is always staying ahead of the standard, just base level requirements. As when we adopted the certification program in 2012, we knew in 2017 the best practices would not be the same as in 2012. Just like in 2020, I'm certain the best practices will evolve from that as well. As for our thoughts on HB 2356 and HB 3188, which are before the committee today, while DBA shares the concerns of the proponents on House Bill 2356, DBA International must regrettably oppose for a number of reasons, including, one, it attempts to adopt DBA standards, certification standards, but fell short to the detriment of consumers. We have a number of high-level certification standards that go significantly above and beyond what's in this bill. The problem that we run into is where they conflict. We require 14 specific data and document elements that must be provided at the point of sale and at the point of purchase. These 14 data and document elements line up with the requirements of both the CFPB as well as the OCC. The OCC is the Office Comptroller of the Currency that regulates the banking industry. And our 14 elements are actually broader than either of those agencies because the CFPB and the FTC do not reflect identical standards. All those 14 standards comprise those two together. So we're completely compliant with both the CFPB and the FTC. In addition to that, we add additional 8 different data and document requirements that we ask certified debt buying companies to get to go go through their reasonable business practices to try to attempt to get these data and documents, which nobody requires, neither the CFPB, the OCC, nor this legislation. So I know people like to refer to spreadsheets. I can't tell you the last time spreadsheets have been the foundation of a debt buyer, a legitimate debt buying company in this country. It definitely predates the certification program, because it's impossible not to have data and documents that back up every element of the debt for any company that's been certified since 2013. So any reference to spreadsheet is certainly referencing situations that may have occurred prior to 2013. Second reason for opposing it is it focuses on the sector of the industry with the least number of complaints, and I'll get into that in a second. Third, it creates an additional licensure that is not needed, as debt buyers are already licensed by DCBS. Four, the new licensure for debt buyers is based on the mortgage broker license requirements rather than the third-party collection agency licensure requirements, which creates two disparate standards for the same industry. Now, I want to explain that a little bit. Debt collection agencies versus debt buying companies, there's only one thing that distinguishes the two. One takes title to the debt, the other doesn't. So third-party collection agencies operate on behalf of the originator or a debt buyer, whereas debt-buying companies take title to the debt, and that's the only thing that distinguishes it. So why we would create two separate licensing structures, one for debt collectors and one for debt buyers, is beyond me. Last night I was actually looking at the DCBS's licensing list of companies that are licensed, and literally almost every single debt buying company that operates in the Northwest are already licensed by DCBS. So we're going to require them to be licensed a second time. I'm not sure how that benefits. Another reason for opposing the bill is that it will drive small businesses that are highly compliant with which also traditionally have no complaints, out of the state. With these additional burdensome compliance requirements, the small compliant debt buyer will not be able to survive, which is going to leave just a handful of companies that will be operating in the debt buying space in the state of Oregon to the detriment of the consumer. Finally, it creates a loophole that ensures that bad actors can escape regulatory enforcement. I'm sure it's not what it was intended, but the definition of debt buyer will lead just to that. To appropriately scope a solution, and you need to understand what the problem is. DBA International often uses statistics in the identification of problems. The federal CFPB Consumer Complaint Portal is one source for these statistics. In reviewing the CFPB complaint statistics for the calendar year 2016 for the state of Oregon, this is what we found. There were 523 complaints from Oregon residents in the area of debt collection. The sector of the debt collection industry with the least number of complaints was the debt buying industry. 85% of Oregon's debt collection complaints were against entities not covered by this bill. So how does this bill proclaim to be a consumer protection when 85% of the complainants would not have received any benefit from this bill being passed? Out of the 218 companies with complaints registered against them in Oregon, 218 companies, only 20 of these companies were debt buying companies. That's 9%. 9% of the companies that had complaints were debt buyer companies. The other 91% were not debt buying companies who are not covered by this bill. Out of the 142 DBA certified companies.
And if you could come to a conclusion here pretty quick,
sure.
That would be great. We have a few other things to do yet today.
Sure. Out of the 20 companies that were debt buying companies, only nine of the complaints were registered against certified companies. With these statistics, what these statistics show is that Oregon does not have a problem in the area of debt collection. What these statistics show is that Oregon does have a problem in the area of debt collection, but it's not with debt buyers. In analyzing the complaints, the biggest problem appeared to be out-of-state third-party debt collectors that represented a staggering 82% of the third-party collection agency complaint volume. Also disturbing was that 55 of these out-of-state third-party collection agencies were not registered with DCBS as a collection agency to do business in Oregon. That's a problem. And I will give credit to the in-state collection agencies. They performed very well. It's the out-of-state third-party collection agencies that had the vast majority of the complaints in this area. I just switching to House Bill 3188 by Representative Rayfield. DBA International supports HB 3188 by Representative Rayfield. This bill will protect consumers by authorizing DCBS to adopt the DBA International certification standards by rule. This single action would set Oregon alone as having the most comprehensive and rigorous consumer protection standards in the nation, bar none. This bill would also allow DCBS to supplement the current state licensing framework for debt collectors by establishing a separate registry for debt buying companies. The framework of this bill came through 8 weeks of negotiations in 2015 conducted by Representative Shamia Fagan, then chair of the House Consumer Protection Committee. Unfortunately, due to time limitations, this bill was not able to get adopted. And in conclusion, what I'll just simply state, and the reason why we think that the approach on 3188 is far more beneficial to consumers than on 2356 is because of the very nature that our certification standards evolve on an annual basis. The standards that were attempted to be copied into 2356 were our 2015 standards. Our standards have significantly evolved since 2015. We're currently on version 5.0, about to adopt version 5.1. The standards that were attempted to be incorporated were version 3.0 standards. And so consequently, for example, on the out-of-stat debt, we've gone so far beyond where the 2356 is in the prior 2 years. Our out-of-stat certification requirements are far, far more protective of consumers than anything that is provided in the other bill, and is the reason why we think that the tying it to 3188 would be far more preferential. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Go ahead for your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman Hull, thank you, members of the committee. My name is Mike Roskam, and I actually am a debt buyer. I have a certified debt buyer at that, and I own a debt buying company and a collection agency, and I collect debts in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. My office is in Vancouver, Washington. We employ 14 people in my office. So I buy and collect debt from originators, the sellers, that they may produce, we'll just call it widgets. They may provide services or widgets, and that's what they're set up to do. And then at some point when an account goes unpaid and they're not able to collect it internally, they sell that debt to the market, the thing we're discussing today, and then we buy those debts on that market. The originators are not set up for long-term debt collections. There's a lot of regulations, as already been explained, and so they sell that off. They recover that on their balance sheet. We purchase it, and then we begin the collection process. And as I said, I do that in Oregon, Washington, Idaho. And since 2000, I've bought a little over 200 portfolios, separate transactions with vendors. And when I buy those, I must comply with all the rules that are already in place at the state level, but also at the federal level. And David already mentioned all the acronyms for that, the FDCPA, FCRA, et cetera. To obtain and keep my certifications, I meet a very high standard that Dave talked about, and I'm audited regularly to those standards by an outside auditor to keep my certification in place, but I'm also audited by vendors, the people that sell me the paper. I have one on April 4th. They're coming in to audit my office as well to check to standards. Are we doing what we say we're doing? So I have to maintain a high level of conduct, ethics, knowledge of what's going on in the industry. The spreadsheet issue, I was sitting in the back when that came up, and with all due respect, I see spreadsheets, but that's not where the source of the debt comes. It's an electronic transfer into our system. And then we get documentation at this point in time, and has been for a couple years now. I won't buy a debt from a seller that I cannot get documentation on. And that documentation is going to include a statement at the very least that shows charge off. In other words, here's what the creditor charged off. It may reflect a last payment date. And sometimes it's maybe one statement. It could be up to 18 statements or a series of statements, and we can request additional documentation as needed. It also needs to come with a clear chain of title. In other words, who owns this debt before I got it? And there's an affidavit, and that says so-and-so owned this debt and had the right to sell that to me, and then I become the legal owner of that debt. So when I pursue this debt, I can provide the documentation to the consumer that here's the debt, here's the complete information on the debt, account numbers, names, last addresses. And so we can kind of work through some of those issues of whether or not we have the correct consumer with the correct documentation. And that's just a standard practice. Charge-off date, last payment dates, if there was one. And all those things are important when it comes to the statute of limitations, which I've heard mentioned earlier today. We're not going to collect in the court system a debt that's beyond the statute of limitations. I'm going to get my little self sued in court by a consumer attorney if I do that. So we're very attentive to what the statute of limitations allows. Also, the complaint process is set up through the CFPB. They have a complaint portal, and we monitor that on a daily basis. I get those things to my phone if there is a complaint, and we didn't have any in 2016, and only a handful since the portal was set up. And a lot of those disputes are misunderstandings. They don't understand. They need more clarification, and those are the type of things, and we deal with those in a timely manner and put those to rest. I do not object to any of the high standards of conduct or requirements that are in 3188. I do support that, but they need to make good sense for small business, and that's really, really important. And I'd certainly be open to any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Bynum.
Thank you so much for both of you testifying today. My question is, why should it be the responsibility of the person who's accused of owing the debt to track down the information regarding the debt?
Come on, I'd like to respond to that. When we reach out to the consumer through the collection process, the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to get a letter saying you're in collections, and they have the opportunity to dispute or respond to that. And if they say we want documentation, we'll provide that documentation. We have that information. It's part of the debt transaction from the seller to us, and we'll have statements that provide documentation to that debt. So we can provide that if it's requested by the consumer.
It's also important to point out that federal law requires for the debt collector to reach out to the consumer. I'm not familiar of any scenario where the consumer has to search for the debt collector. It's actually the other way around.
Thank you. Would really like to move on. One last question, Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just trying to understand. It sure seems to me as though in your statements that you're already going so far above and beyond, because you keep repeating that you have 14 elements, you go above and beyond, you're already broader. So to me, why are you even opposing this if you're already so far above and beyond? What's the real issue?
Well, several reasons. The devil's in the details, and the way that some of the provisions of the Act is written, we can't comply with them. Secondly, some of the language in the bill would contradict our certification program standards. So we want to make sure that right now we make it that we require all of our certified companies cannot sue on a debt beyond the statute of limitations anywhere in the country, regardless of what state law says. And we go above and beyond that and say that any debt that you receive payment on that's already beyond the statute of limitations, that any certified company will not treat that payment to revive the statute of limitations in order to bring suit, which is something that 47 states allow for that, but we indicate that all certified companies will not engage in that activity.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, I'd like to have Sonia Gibson and Matt Marquis. Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, my name is Sonia Gibson. I'm here representing Encore Capital Group. I'd like to thank you, Chair Holvey, and members of the committee for listening to my testimony. A little bit of background about Encore, very briefly. We purchase primarily credit card debt from all the major banks, and we do not purchase medical or student loan debt. We have very strict guidelines around consumer protection. For example, Encore does not charge any interest and fees. The balance that you know from your issuer is going to be the balance we collect. We do not credit report if the consumer is making payments to our company. And we don't collect on active duty military, on hardship accounts. And we also provide robust disclosures to our consumers. A few of the things I want to do, first of all, thank you, Chair Holvey and the Attorney General's office for their willingness to work on the language and bring it to what we think is going to provide consumer protection but still allow companies like Encore to do business in the state, responsible actors to do business in the state. For example, when we typically do not support legislation where there are documents required that simply do not exist in the course of business or we wouldn't be able to obtain from the creditors or the issuers, and I believe that the amendments discussed with the Attorney General's office will be able to come to that and do allow for documents to be obtained by companies, responsible actors, and so we feel that that's a good compromise that's been reached, and we want to protect consumers, but we also want to keep the industry operating in the state to keep the cost of interest low and access of credit available to the very consumers who need it the most. And we believe in licensing, and we believe in weeding out the bad actors, and we feel that this compromise will do all of those things.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association today. My client is a group of mostly Oregon domiciled collection agencies, not debt buyers. But as you've heard from previous witnesses, this bill definitely does affect more than just debt buyers and affects everybody collecting the debt, not just my client as a third party debt collector, but all first party collectors as well, being a retailer or medical provider or whomever. I will try to make my comments brief as I know you have a lot to do today, but I do just want to say a couple of things from previous testimony that referenced default rates when somebody is sued, and I don't want folks to think that just because a default is entered into the court system means that the person that was being sued didn't realize they were being sued or for some reason the debt was not theirs. And there are a high number of debtors that talk to our clients and say, please sue me, let's get the garnishment process started. The only way to start that is through a lawsuit. And they don't have time to deal with the court. They know that they owe the debt, and that's why oftentimes a default judgment is taken as opposed to going through some lengthy process. That's not to say it happens all the time, but that is sometimes why that does happen. And to Representative Evans' question earlier as far as the most recent set of amendments to 2356, I appreciate the chair and everybody that's worked on those. I think they're very, very close to something that my client could be okay with. There are three areas in which we're still working to fine-tune that language to make sure it says what it means. And I think it's important to know that our Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act here in Oregon is a strict liability statute, which in a sense means that if you make a mistake, you can be liable for those actions and be sued. And so it's very careful to know what that says and how it is written. In the federal act, there are things like a bona fide error that you can show that you have processes and procedures in place to avoid making those mistakes, and that can be part of your defense. In Oregon, that is missing, and so that language around how those are written is very, very critical to this process. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions. I know you're short on time, and I'm here every day.
Thank you. And committee, we will be, of course, having another round of this when we actually come back with the Dash 1 amendments. So I will be having invited testimony at that time for certain. So any questions for this panel? Thank you very much for both being here to testify. I know there's two more people left to testify, but if time allows, I'll come back to this public hearing, but I'm going to move on with a different public hearing at the moment. So I'm going to close, and hopefully temporarily for today, House Bill 2356 and House Bill 3188, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2581.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure requires a person who possesses or has access to account information as a consequence of a consumer transaction to notify the consumer, the financial institution, the merchant service provider, and in certain situations, the Attorney General when a security breach occurs. It expands the definition of personal information to include account information, and it subjects a person to liability to the financial institution for costs incurred as a result of security breach if they failed to comply with the standards for safeguarding the account information, which would amount to gross negligence. Dash 1 amendment before you removes the proposed liability of the person whose failure to safeguard the account information amounts to gross negligence. It also removes the emergency clause.
Thank you. Representatives Olson and Representatives Rayfield, if you could identify yourselves for the record.
We can do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Andy Olson from House District 15, which is the Albany area.
And Dan Rayfield from House District 16, which is the Philomath, Corvallis, and Oregon State University region.
We'd be neighbors.
So you neighbors would like to deliver
yes,
some
we'll
testimony.
Here. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you very much. House Bill 2581. Too often companies that maintain sensitive and confidential information are not held accountable for paying the full costs associated with the data breach. For example, they are not required to cover the cost of credit monitoring or identity theft repair. They are not responsible for the costs of reissuing compromised cards or making consumers whole if they suffer a loss, and they are not responsible for notifying individuals or financial institutions in a timely manner that their data has been lost or stolen. This bill simply improves the notification requirements so that those harmed don't suffer unnecessary financial damages because they were not informed that their data had been lost or stolen at the time of detection. Data breaches are inevitable, but companies that are responsible for securing sensitive information must be held accountable for notifying the individuals or financial institutions that have had a breach or potential breach at the time they become aware.
So Representative Holby, members of the committee, so Dan Rayfield again for the record. This bill came to us, and I think Representative Olson does a really good job of describing, you know, one of the problems that were kind of identified for us in our local community where we have a credit union who is outside the traditional contract in a normal setting. And so a credit union who has, say, a Visa card or a debit card, they're clients or customers are using this in, say, a restaurant, and there's a lot of examples which will be given a little bit later. That data, because it is not protected, is then used later on, and the integrity of the card itself is compromised, and so you have credit unions, outside entities, that actually have to spend money on reissuing the cards. They have to spend money on administrative time and a lot of other costs that they then themselves take on, which then, quite frankly, gets transferred on to their clients. And so this bill was really pointed at addressing that underlying issue of how do we encourage the folks who are actually causing the breach of the data to take responsibility and really tighten down as a prevention. We don't want to be punitive with the way that we approach this, but what we do want to do is ensure that you have a customer who has their data that is being breached, and then also you have a institution, a financial institution that is incurring costs, and then passing them on to that same customer that has had their own data already being breached. And that's what this bill was really intended to do. When we sat down, we addressed it. We thought we were doing such a great job when we were drafting this thing, the two of us, partners in crime, Albany and Corvallis. That's the way we're always seen. Sorry. I shouldn't say partners in crime with a former Oregon State Trooper sitting next to me. But, you know, we were working together, and we then realized that there were some people who disagreed with the initial draft of this. And so we're currently in the process of trying to bring people together to find a solution to really get at that underlying interest. And I think you'll hear that from the folks testifying after us.
Thank you very much for bringing the bill forward. You have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Up next, Rick Hine, Rob Stewart, and Hal Scoggins.
No questions for the odd couple?
No questions?
I look, nobody asked. Nobody raised their hand. I just kept moving.
About the matching ties.
What's with the outfits here?
Cute. They're got matching ties.
I think partners in crime was worth a discussion.
We are in public hearing. Just to remind you. Welcome, gentlemen, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Hovey and members of the committee. My name is Richard Hine. I'm the President, Chief Executive Officer of Oregon State Credit Union, State Chartered Credit Union, Corvallis-based, and we are owned by our members, 100,000 members, in 24 counties in Central and Western Oregon. In total candor, it's unfortunate that we are here discussing legislation today that is needed to remedy what should be common considered accepted practice of notification when an organization loses confidential information trusted to them in the sales process by a consumer. I think Oregon consumers, especially the 2 million members of credit unions out there, have grown numb to the frequency of account security breaches, resulting in countless card replacements, legal costs, and long-lasting effects of account compromises. Who among us have not had their card, credit or debit, needing to be replaced once or twice or even more in the last year? We continue to see headlines almost monthly regarding the data breaches, such as a recent incident at a large restaurant chain, which now is in litigation, where their defense alleges that the restaurant chain has no liability to safeguard sensitive member customer information to provide adequate notification of data because there are no regulations or legislation requiring them to do so. To add salt to the wound, at times merchants actually experience a win-win in data breaches, first by not shouldering any of the consequences of the data being stolen from their care, and then as gift cards, products, and services are purchased and transactions completed with the stolen card data before the financial institution is alerted to be able to defend against the stolen data that was obtained. And the real victims here are our members and the Oregon consumers, who must continue their due diligence against the long-lasting potential effects of identity theft and account takeovers that often result years after the data was stolen, all of which consumers spend countless hours and dollars to correct this issue over the years. In 2006, Visa notified our credit union of more than 200 distinct breach alerts at businesses of all sizes. Those often don't include the small local breaches. One very small local retail business was naively compromised through their use of an unsecure Wi-Fi used at their transaction point. We had 12 members who were impacted by this and resulted in losses of $52,000. One member by themselves had a $24,000 fraudulent charge on their card. Working with the Department of Justice, we were able to determine the common merchant between the 12 members. We contacted the merchant with the information that we and the Department of Justice had accumulated. The merchant advised us they didn't care. They didn't have any reason or requirement to do anything about that unprotected Wi-Fi. The response was different when the Department of Justice went and had the very same conversation with them. Not coincidentally, the fraud ceased once the Department of Justice and the Wi-Fi was secured. Overall, we have reissued approximately 4,200 cards and incurred hard costs of approximately $563,000. That does not include staff time and the pursuit of criminals through available legal channels, saving the member time and expenses. While it would be preferred that we tackle the needed safeguards at the point of sale, I'm aware that this bill has been amended to emphasize the merchant's timely notification of such breaches. We appreciate and applaud the opportunity to bring this issue to the committee and to the victimized consumer. We support data security standards for all entities handling sensitive customer information. We believe these standards should mirror those that we and other credit unions exercise under the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. If merchants, big and small, were to do so, we can keep the consumer's confidential information much more secured and less susceptible to today's organized but commonplace attacks. I want to thank our representatives Dan Rayfield and Andy Olson for authoring this common sense bipartisan legislation, and I thank you for your time, service, and consideration of House Bill 2581.
Good afternoon, Chair Hovey and members of the committee. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. My name is Rob Stewart, and I'm the president and CEO of On Point Community Credit Union, headquartered in Portland. My role today is to share with you the impacts of plastic card fraud with our members and on credit unions. But first, I'd like to tell you a little bit about On Point. On Point serves nearly 320,000 members in our community, which includes 13 counties in Oregon, spanning from Eugene to Portland, and including three counties in Central Oregon. We also serve two counties in southwestern Washington that round out the Portland metropolitan area. We started as Portland Teachers Credit Union in 1932 and changed to our community charter and the name On Point in 2006. As a member-owned financial services cooperative, On Point takes its responsibility to protect member information extremely seriously, to protect our members and to comply with state and federal regulations. As payment systems of choice, debit and credit cards are used by our members every day to help meet their financial needs and goals. Given our sole purpose of serving our membership, OnPoint strives to provide them with the tools they need to be successful, including debit and credit cards. However, these cards can expose member information to card fraudsters at the point of transaction due to lower security requirements in place for both merchants, for merchants other than other financial institutions. Let me provide a few facts from OnPoint's 2016 operations related to card data breaches to illustrate the impact. During 2016, OnPoint identified 301 card compromises that impacted nearly 58,000 cards and members. Over 32,000 cards were affected in a single data breach that occurred at a national restaurant chain. Each time an identifiable card breach occurs, OnPoint cancels and reissues thousands of plastic cards to our members. Here are a few specific impacts to both consumers and to credit unions. Members must update any reoccurring charges that may occur or may have taken place with our cards, such as periodic insurance premium payments and registered services such as Uber and iTunes. This creates negative experiences for our members. If a card is canceled when the member attempts to make a purchase or is traveling, transactions may be denied, which is significantly inconvenience them or cause hardship to the member. When a member information is stolen, it can result in long-term identity fraud challenges for members that require our time and diligence to resolve. From a credit union perspective, reputation impact for members believing the mishandling of card data is due to the credit union's security practices rather than the merchants. Consumers often do not understand where the breach occurred. Hard dollar losses of the amounts paid to members to make them whole, as required by Visa, which are not recuperated by the credit union. OnPoint lost $1.9 million due to card breaches in 2016, and lost more in deposit product fraud overall than loan product losses in 2016. Increased expense for reissuing plastic cards, which cost approximately $9.25 per card for 2016, totaled $535,000. As these facts illustrate, the impact of card data breaches on members and consumers and on credit unions is significant. The Northwest Credit Union Association Governmental Affairs Committee, of which I am the co-chair, supports House Bill 2581 as a step towards tightening standards around card data, and I ask for your support for this bill. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today and for your considerations. Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley Wada Witt in Portland. We're the outside counsel for the Northwest Credit Union Association and for many of the credit unions in Oregon and Washington. I will give you some brief background about this bill and how it came about and what it does, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. You've heard not just here in regarding this bill, but earlier regarding the other bills that that our Attorney General testified about and others, there's a lot of focus on identity theft and its impact on consumers. What doesn't get talked about nearly as much is the type of loss that impacts financial institutions, similar to identity theft, and creates an indirect cost to consumers in Oregon. You've just heard examples of that from the two gentlemen sitting to my left. Oregon law currently focuses on identity theft and its impact on consumers and prevention of identity theft. Oregon has information security requirements related to consumer information, but again, its focus is on consumers and not on financial institutions and card data, and either preventing or mitigating losses that can come from card data breaches. As an illustration, one thing that happens is if I use my card at a merchant and my card data is breached at that merchant can't necessarily notify me as a consumer because all it has is my card number and my signature. It doesn't necessarily have my address, my phone number, or any other means to contact me. So what Representatives Rayfield and Olson have done is to put forth a bill that attempts to at least make some effort at dealing with the issue of card data breaches and their impact on financial institutions and allowing financial institutions to both work to prevent further damage from those card data breaches and also potentially to mitigate losses if they do occur. Other bills around the country, other state legislatures have either addressed or attempted to address this in numerous ways. It's not an easy problem. There have been bills put forth to require merchants with breaches to provide free credit monitoring for consumers that are affected. There have been bills in some places and, in fact, have been adopted in some places, including Minnesota, where Target is headquartered, and Washington, to our north, that actually do impose liability on merchants that suffer card data breaches through negligence or gross negligence or some other standard. There also have been bills that allow state attorneys general or consumer protection agencies to enforce standards that are imposed on merchants. What this bill as drafted would have done is three things. It would have first required the merchant that suffers a card data breach to notify its processor and to notify the financial institutions that were involved. It would also impose liability on merchants who were grossly negligent, not just who were simply negligent, but who were grossly negligent in handling the information that they had from the card transactions. And also it would have allowed the DCVS to put forth standards that would apply to merchants in maintaining their information. We understand amendments have been put forth that would or potentially further amendments would do would take away everything but just the requirement for merchants to notify the financial institutions and their processors. And what this would do is allow financial institutions to proactively, again, work to try and prevent further fraud, to get cards reissued sooner, to maybe notify their cardholders when the merchants couldn't notify the cardholders because they didn't have the information. And so it would at least take some step in working to mitigate this fraud or this these losses from this fraud. And it would also potentially at least provide a little bit further incentive than what's there now, which is virtually nothing, for merchants to maintain better security over that information. So that's what this bill would do with the amendments that are there. We recognize that The solutions aren't easy. We understand that merchants have questions about how they would go about notifying financial institutions. The data on the financial institutions is available from card processors and from Visa and MasterCard, the other card companies. Merchants would have to go and get that information from their processors, and then they'd be able to notify the financial institutions that issued the cards. But again, at least it's a step. It's a way that we could start to do something to put the impetus or the onus back on the merchants where these breaches occur, as opposed to the financial institutions, which have no control over what the merchants are doing. So with that, I'll stop, and I'll thank you for your time and your attention. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you very much for bringing this issue forward and speaking to it. It does seem like a big issue. Representative Barreto, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. If we have someone breach our card, usually we get a call from LifeLock or something like that. As far as a merchant, if they've had a breach, how are they contacted and how do they know that they've had that breach?
Chair Hovey, Representative Barreto, that can happen in a number of different ways, and it really just depends on the circumstances. It could be that the merchant finds out on its own that something happens in the course of the merchant's business where it discovers, oh, wow, somebody's been accessing our information illegally or funneling it out of, or it gets a complaint from somebody who had fraud on their card. More likely, the major card companies, Visa or MasterCard, start to see a pattern, and they may trace it back and say, okay, there's a common denominator at this merchant, or it may be local authorities have done an investigation. I mean, it could arise any number of different ways.
Thank you.
So several of the explanations you gave would be down the road, with the other institutions, with the card suppliers, whatever. It seems like there's a lot of people that might find out by several different ways, but the merchant then would be held responsible or culpable.
Chair Hovey, Representative Barreto. First of all, with the amendments, the merchant wouldn't even be held culpable. It's just they would have to notify the financial institutions. But finding out about the existence of a breach is different from finding out exactly what cards were involved in the breach and then going back and determining who the institutions were that held those cards. And that information, it may be that local authorities discover there was a breach or someone else discovers that there was a breach, but it's the merchant that actually has the data available to it to say, okay, based on what we know, here are the cards that were involved. Now that we know that somebody captured all of our information from this date to that date, then it's the merchant and only the merchant who has the data available to it to be able to say, okay, based on that, these are the cards we believe were involved in the breach.
Thank you. And just for clarity, were you speaking in favor of the Dash 1 amendment?
Chair Hovey, yes, we were speaking in favor of the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you.
And we're open to further discussion on the issue, anything that's reasonable.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen, so much for your testimony today. I appreciate it. Up next, Betsy Earls, Sean Miller, and Ben Eckstein. Excuse me.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing the Oregon Retail Council, which is a part of Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Business Association. We're appearing before you today in opposition to House Bill 2581, which imposes duplicative requirements on merchants that handle credit card transactions. The bill does this by requiring notice to financial institutions that have issued a financial access device, which most of us think of as a credit card, or any merchant services provider that processed a financial transaction on the person's behalf if they were using account information that was subject to a breach of security. This is entirely impractical for our members and for retailers in general because merchants don't have access to this type of information. The payment card data security standard, to which all merchants must agree in order to handle payment card transactions, already requires immediate notification of a breach of credit or debit card information, the notification must be made to the payment card network or to the card processors. So the merchant has made the agreement with those companies, and they notify those companies back when there's a breach that has already occurred. Those companies are then in position to notify the card issuing banks themselves or law enforcement in the event of a serious incident. So the companies that the retailers have to notify that they had the agreement with are in much better position to reach back out to the issuing banks than the retailer is, who may or may not have access to that information. Our members already comply with relevant data security laws, and accordingly, we implement sound information security practices that protect the security and confidentiality of our customers' personal information. We urge your opposition to the impractical requirements of House Bill 2581, and additionally urge you to consider the impact that this bill would have, especially on small retailers and merchants that would have this additional burden of reaching back out to every issuing bank in a situation where they have suffered from a security breach. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in opposition to House Bill 2581, which does impose and pushes the liability onto businesses involving this breach of security devices. It does create the private right of action, allowing financial institutions to recover security breach-related costs for those that have access to this information. It's very broad cost recovery in the bill, including costs of canceling, reissuing the credit card, debit card, stopping payments or blocking those transactions, closing or reopening an account, and refusing or crediting consumer transactions, and even notifying the consumer. As Betsy indicated, a lot of this information is very impractical for businesses and would put a lot of burden upon our business community. And, you know, again, the Dash 1 amendment, I will state just real quickly, that it does not address any of our concerns. Mr. Chair, we oppose the bill. We oppose the Dash 1 amendments. And I heard the prior panel talking about having conversations with the business community. As for financial institutions, this is just brought forward by the credit unions, and they have not talked to us to this date. And we've had a few conversations. We've had no conversations in the interim involving the credit unions associations and the impact to the business community in Oregon. And so I just until the bill came up, we were not aware of the bill and its implications to the business community. Thank you.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, my name is Ben Eckstein, here on behalf of the Computing Technology Industry Association, CompTIA. We're a membership organization representing companies all across the information technology spectrum, from small IT service providers and software developers to larger equipment manufacturers and telecom companies. Not only do we share the goal of protecting consumer information, CompTIA members are also on a daily basis doing much of the work and at the leading edge in developing technologies and systems that make it possible for businesses to secure their data. CompTIA members are also educating and training businesses across the country on how to effectively secure data and promoting initiatives to do so. So it's not just an issue that affects CompTIA members, but also very much our members are engaged in taking a leadership role in data security. We oppose House Bill 2581 as the wrong approach to improving data security. We need continued education and training to employers as we learn more about cybersecurity and develop better strategies to prevent breaches. We also need more support for research and innovation so that CompTIA members and businesses can respond to technological changes and craft secure data processing that responds to changes in technology so that businesses can adapt. Our view is that House Bill 2581 would detract from these necessary efforts by diverting resources that should be invested in innovation, training, education, into litigation. As technology changes rapidly, so do the most effective methods that we have to protect consumer information, and targeting gross negligence will cost all businesses an increased legal and risk management, but it will not do anything to help the vast majority of businesses businesses that constantly work to improve their data processing and data security, and in many cases do so with the help of CompTIA members. We've also submitted written testimony that's a bit more comprehensive and is on OLIS and available, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Questions for this panel. Representative Evans.
Yeah, sorry, but I'm just trying to understand here just for a second. Aren't credit unions and the financial sector part of the business community? Because I'm kind of getting tired of hearing about burdens on business. This one wasn't brought by us. So my question is, isn't this being done to try to protect your customers, to have access so that people can actually buy goods and services from your customers? Isn't that the whole point of this thing? Any can answer.
Chair Holvey, Representative Evans, I think absolutely we view the whole business community as needing and benefiting from data security. CompTIA members,
because it's being queued up like it's against the business community. It's the other part of the business community asking for help on this. So just trying to clarify.
Definitely. CompTIA definitely views itself as a part of the business community. And like I said, Chair Holvey, Representative Evans, CompTIA members are working every day to help the business community secure data. This bill takes an approach that, in CompTIA's view, is not going to help businesses to do that and actually will divert resources away from those efforts, is CompTIA's view.
No other answers to that. I thank you very much for your testimony. I hope that, you know, we can clarify a little bit what's in the bill, what's out of the bill, and that you can have some conversations with the stakeholders about coming to grips with this. When I look at the Dash 1 amendment, I thought liability was largely taken out in the Dash 1, but you didn't see it quite the same way, perhaps, and, you know, but anyway, I would love that if you were able to have a conversation with the business community to solve this issue. That would, because, the resources that this is diverting away, the way I understood it, it looks like it's the resources of the financial industry that are the ones that are losing out here mostly. So it seems like something we should really take a good crack at solving. So I would appreciate your conversations in helping get us somewhere that that the business community can support in large. So,
Mr. Chair, the business community will certainly work with the rest of the business community to talk about what's to be done in this situation.
That's what I was looking for.
How about that?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Up next, Sharon Prentice.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Sharon Prentice with the Oregon State Treasurer's Office, and I'm here today because we have a concern about the practical application of the bill, and we would like to work with the credit unions, if this bill moves forward, to ensure that it doesn't create undue burden or additional requirements for, in particular, state agencies that are already meeting the payment card industry data security standards, and then also the agreements between the merchant card services providers for reporting purposes and so forth, and all the state agencies.
Thank you for that. I'll commend you to the conversation I just mentioned, and I'm sure you can find people in this room that will take your name and phone number.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you being here. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2581. In committee, we have just about 6 minutes left. I'd like to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2184 to get a couple of people up that normally aren't in the building. Tyson Stuber and Carl, do you want to go ahead and join him? Carl Redman.
Excuse me.
So just a minute and a half apiece would, I know it's maybe a bigger conversation if we'll have another hearing. If you're willing to come back, I could just move on and you can try again on another day, but I want to give you an opportunity if you can't come back. So.
All right, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thanks for the short and brief opportunity to speak with you today.
And I'd be more than happy to come back if that's beneficial to the conversation.
I'll take you up on that.
I'd be willing to come back also. I'd appreciate that.
Oh, well, that makes it pretty simple. Does our Wednesday calendar look like we might be able to get to this one?
It's possible.
So I think we're going to carry this over till Wednesday. So I appreciate you. I just wanted to make sure you were able to come back before I moved on. So thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2184. We have time for one more piece of testimony. We have a work session as well.
It's two work sessions, if you can squeeze in.
Two work sessions. Okay, so we won't open anything else back up. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2855.
A work session?
Yes, a work session on House Bill 2855.
Okay, Mr. Chair and committee members, this bill is a committee bill. It was heard by the committee March 1st. It creates a process for the purchaser of real property to obtain the deed of conveyance without taking legal action when the contract has been fulfilled. The Dash 2 amendment clarifies that any failure to provide notice to any particular junior interest holder does not diminish the effect of the notices given to the seller and the junior interest holders that are claiming through the seller. No revenue impact on the Dash 2 amendment, and there is a minimal expenditure impact.
So, Tess, would you like to describe the Dash 2 amendment, or do you think it was covered well?
I think it was covered well.
Okay. Are there any, first of all, let me take a motion on the Dash 2.
Okay. Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2855.
Representative Bynum moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2855. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the Dash 2 amendments adopted.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2855 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bynum moves House Bill 2855 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Thank you. With that, Kayla, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Jordy.
Aye.
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative Fahey.
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Kerr?
Yes.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holvey?
Aye. House Bill 2855, having received their votes, is passed. Representative Kinnemer, would you like to carry this for us?
Could do that.
Thank you. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2855 and open up a work session on House Bill 3337.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a bill that's sponsored by Representative Hurd. The committee has not heard the bill, but the chair would like to move it without recommendation to the House Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development. It's a bill that creates a limited landscape construction professional license that allows a licensee to perform all phases of landscape construction work, but limited to projects that individually do not exceed $8,000 within a 12-month period. It exempts limited landscape construction professional licensee from the examination and experience requirements. There are no amendments, there is a fiscal statement issued, and there's no revenue impact.
Researches things, he writes notes.
Thank you.
Let's go see if he's got better memory than I do.
Chair, I move House Bill 3337 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development.
Representative Bynum moves House Bill 3337 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Is there discussion? I just want to apologize to Representative Hurd that I tried to get to this one on our agenda, but our agendas sometimes take a long time to get through all our questions and answers, and I think that committee will have a little more time to deal with this before our deadlines. Yep. So good luck.
Thank you.
With that, could we have a roll call vote, Kayla?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Yes.
Representative Fetterer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3337, never see the required votes, is passed. Does that wrap up our agenda, except that we will carry over House Bill 2184 to Wednesday, our next meeting. And with that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business and Legislation.